Hi, everyone. I'm Mike Gasowitz, CEO of Tricert Financial Group, and welcome to another episode of In Focus. Today, we're going to talk about our financial sector and how it did in the third quarter of the year. And joining me today is Lee Grimshaw, one of our portfolio managers responsible for the financial sector. Welcome, Lee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. And I'm Lee Grimshaw, and I've been part of the financial coverage group for probably 4 years now at this particular institution, and then previously with private equity in the banking sector.
Yeah, good to have some background on you, Lee. Good stuff. So just maybe give a reminder to the listeners, what are the subsectors? What companies are comprised of the financial sector?
Yeah, there's quite a few subsectors within the finance sector. We have core picks in approximately five of those sectors, being insurance companies, property and casualty. Most specifically, that would be represented by a company that we would all, I think most people would know, and that would be Berkshire Hathaway. National commercial banks, which is no stranger, that would be companies such as the Royal Bank, the TD Bank, Bank of America, JP Morgan, security brokers and dealers, that would be examples of those types of companies, would be like Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, credit services. So very familiar names like Visa and MasterCard, and then life insurance and Canadian brand names such as Sun Life and Manulife Financial. So, and we're currently doing a review of all of the different subsectors. As I indicated, there's 17, so there's quite a few. But we expect and we hope in the near term to expand that coverage to a few other spaces. And those spaces would be such as the mega cap insurance brokers. And so those would be companies like Marsh McLennan. I think people would know that name. Arthur J. Gallagher, which people probably wouldn't know as much, and Aon, which is a British global insurance provider. And then exchanges and data services. So that would be companies like the S&P, SBGI specifically, Moody's Corporation, the data analytics and rating companies. And then finally, alternative asset management is a third sector that has, quote unquote, piqued our interest, and a pun was intended there. And so those would be companies like KKR and Apollo. And they're sort of, besides Brookfield Asset Management, some of the largest private equity firms in the world.
Okay. It's good to see that we look at the across the whole spectrum to see what we should include and possibly exclude. So that's good to know. So why don't we focus on the banking sector to start off with, and maybe talk about what's keeping you up at night and what's helping you get to sleep.
Yeah. And there's lots to certainly in the banking sector right now, there's lots to keep us up at night, but we actually look at it, putting the vernacular aside for a moment. We actually look at it the same way that we would look at a traditional company. It's just that there's a lot of vernacular around things like net interest income. What is net interest income? That would be the top line of a bank, and that would be exactly as it sounds, interest that is derived from their loan books, less whatever costs might be on their deposits. Other things like what they call near or non-interest revenue, and that would be fee-based revenue. And so we all know and love the types of fees that we get charged by the banks, but that adds the mix in particular adds to a lot of the stability that we see in the Canadian banking system. And then there's this thing called NIMS or net interest margin, and that's effectively like a gross margin or the amount of money that you make on the spread between the net interest income and plus the fees minus whatever costs associated with deposits. And so that certainly, I think, for the most part, is a well-managed component of the bank, of the banking context. And that doesn't keep me up at night, other than the fact that those particular items are largely driven by Things that are slightly beyond the bank's controls, such as interest rate rises by the Central Bank of Canada, the yield curve that is largely more supply and demand driven in the capital market space. Things that keep me up at night would be things like credit reserves. So we've probably all seen there's an article that's been trending recently that was published by the Royal Bank of Capital, and they're talking about the $500 billion in mortgage, residential mortgage renewals that are coming up over the next 3 years. And so that is certainly an element, I think, that keeps everybody up at night, and especially the executives at the bank. Capital markets performance. Capital markets is one of the most profitable areas of the banking sector. And right now it's in a bit of a lull. We think for the most part that it's bottomed. When the turnaround comes is hopefully 2024, 2025, we will see that. But that's an area of great concern and thinking that we have around the banks, given the intense profitability. Certainly for some, we've seen a revision of estimates in the space for capital markets in 2024, and that should improve 9% roughly if the estimates come true versus a relatively flat result for 2023. And one of the largest beneficiaries, we think, will be the growth at TD, primarily due to the acquisition of Cowen Investment Bank. And so we think that should be a reasonably good area of performance in the near term. Another thing that keeps me up at night is the SG&A, and what I mean by that is the overhead and really wages. And so what we've seen with inflation at the banks is a real cost increase. There has been some charges to try to normalize that particular overhead. You've seen it out of Scotia, you've seen it out of Royal Bank, not as much from TD recently, but I think they're in a place where they can manage their overhead with natural attrition. And then finally, I think the last thing that keeps me up at night is what we call capital buffers, or the regulated capital that the regulators want the banks to hold back in case of financially difficult times. In December 2022, OSFI raised what they call the domestic stability buffer to 3% from 2.5%. So with the reasoning that the high household indebtedness and the rapid rise in interest rates had increased risk for the Canadian banks. And so the latest increase in this DSB, or domestic stability buffer, is effective November 1st, 2023. And this is going to ensure that Canada's six largest banks keep their so-called Tier 1 capital buffer at least 11.5%. And so that has been going up steadily over time, if you look back over 20 years. And so, you know, I think you can give, I think on one hand, it gives a great cause of comfort for individuals that have investments in the Canadian banking stocks. And then on the negative side, of course, though, the higher the capital buffer, the bigger issue is with it provides headwinds to profitability, dividend increases, and share buybacks, because they have to hold more capital on their balance sheet. So that is
basically
the negative.
As a shareholder, that money's got to stay relatively liquid, so they can't necessarily put it to work. And as you say, maybe as a consumer and also as a shareholder, in terms of ensuring that the entity survives any very rough waters. But it can be, as you said, some headwinds in terms of the earnings.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's what keeps me up. Sorry.
Okay. So generally in the quarter, how did the markets react? And maybe even talk a bit about the differences between the Canadian banks on our core pick list versus, say, the U.S. banks. Are we seeing much of a difference there?
Yeah. So the big cap banks in the States did quite well in the last quarter, led by JP Morgan, Bank of America, a little bit behind the results of a JP Morgan. The difference between the two banks, in particular in the U.S., those in particular, was the fact that JP Morgan decided not to invest a lot of their excess capital in things like mortgage-backed securities that have longer duration. And what I mean by that is, as we probably many of us have seen in their bond portfolios, those bonds that have a longer duration with the rise in interest rates suffered. And so the same issue came to fruition with the U.S. banks. The other positive, I would say, so JP Morgan did well, Bank of America not so well. Things that they did well, though, they managed the what they call deposit betas, or the migration of and the seeking of the increased interest rates in their deposit books. They managed that particularly well. And the Canadian banks did the same. But if you were to look to the regional banks in the U.S., they did not do as well. And that's expected, I think, with a lot of the different issues that we've seen in the newspaper with respect to the regional banks. And interestingly, the U.S. divisions of the Canadian banks actually followed a similar pattern as the regional banks. So there was a bit of a difference. And then finally, one last thing is the Canadian banks, at least in their Canadian divisions, have a much higher service revenue in their top line. So while the net interest margin is smaller, it's much more stable. And so they don't, on one hand, they don't have as much torque as I would say with respect to rises in interest rates, but at the same time, they have a much more stable income base.
So again, sort of the love-hate relationship with Canadian banks.
Yeah.
And as you say, the word torque, so as interest rates go up and back to that net interest margin, Canadian banks not as, you know, call it sensitive from a positive perspective in terms of earning more, but more stable because, well, we pay fees and that stabilizes things. So, okay, good. Why don't we, let's shift gears then to the insurance side of the financial sector. What are we seeing there?
Yeah, so let's hone in on Berkshire. So interestingly, Berkshire, which is not all property and casualty, but in reinsurance, but it is one of their biggest divisions. And I think we've seen some pretty strong tailwinds with respect to that particular part of the industry in the financial sector. And part of it is the reinsurance pricing and what we call P&C or property and casualty pricing has been exhibited some really strong increases over the past year. And it's what we call, or what they call in the industry, the hard and soft cycle of the market. And in this particular instance, the property and casualty insurance has been in a bit of a what they call a hard market for the past 6 years. And given inflation is coming into the marketplace, we think that hard market, so to speak, is going to continue. And what we mean from a hard market perspective is that there's periods of dislocation when insurance capacity is difficult to obtain for insurance buyers. And so it leads to hard prices or prices going up. And that's been going on for 6 years. Now, the question is, why does that happen? Part of the answer is the other half of Berkshire's insurance business, or reinsurance. And so and reinsurance is when an insurance company goes and lays off, so to speak, the risk profile for their underwriting book. And so for the past sort of 5 years, the global insurance reinsurance market has had losses of about $120 to $125 billion. probable culprits to that: climate change, higher value of insured assets, population growth. That's the fifth year in history that insured losses were greater than $100 billion. And so, in no surprise, the participants have largely retracted from the industry, and that's led to a higher cost base and the inability to lay off some of the risk by the actual originators of insurance. And so, for the first time in this past year, the reinsurance market has actually rebounded in their ability to create profits. And so that has continued to, and I think what's interesting is that it hasn't really attracted an enormous amount of new capital, just given the track record of losses in the space. And so that's led to another hard market in the reinsurance capacity, where there's good pricing, good profitability. They're making rates of returns around 17% versus an average of 6% over the past 5 years. And so that's a big opportunity for the companies like Berkshire. Rising interest rates have also eroded the capital position for insurance companies and reduced the allure of yield provided by insurance-linked securities. And so finally, inflation impacts insurance. So if you have to effectively protect the value of a product 5 years out and inflation is moving rapidly, then you have to increases both demand and supply, and that you have to increase your prices and you have to increase your payouts. And so you can't really do that until that shows up on the balance sheet and the P&L with respect to the regulated underlying insurance contracts.
Okay, Lee. Well, that's good to hear in terms of seeing what's happened in the insurance. And again, it's interesting between banking and insurance companies, but as shareholders, you have a different perspective, right? So a hard market is actually something that as shareholders, we like to see, because that means you can start to increase prices and hopefully that turns to, again, increased profitability. So Lee, thank you so much for this update. All right, folks, as always, if you have any questions about what you've heard or anything about your portfolio, even your financial plan, don't hesitate to talk to your financial advisor. And as always, reach out to your TriCert Investment Counsel portfolio manager, and also feel free to reach out to myself. Take care.